maybe not so difficult to get one sensational shot.
Hi there, you're listening to One Sensational Shot, the podcast where we like to talk about the films that matter most to us. My name is Luke Littleboy. I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Fletcher Walton. Fletcher, how have you been?
Hello, very well, thank you very much. I finally got over that illness. I think you might have it now.
Yeah, I think I do, actually.
Just about 18, 20, 21 days. The stag do didn't help in the middle, but it was really enjoyable, so I don't mind about that. And after finally escaping this illness cloud that was over me, I've been able to get along to the cinema. Last week I saw three films, so we'll talk about that in a bit.
Oh, excellent. I'm really looking forward to that. I, in stark contrast, have not managed to get to the cinema. Since the stag do, I've been doing nothing but wedding planning. So it's been intense. Just last weekend, drove from Bournemouth, where I'm living, up to Suffolk, where the wedding's going to be. Met with a venue, had a suit fitting as well. Went up to Norwich, where my brother's living, and had my I was fitted for a suit. Also, they kept I started on my old suit size, and then they kept going. They kept bringing out bigger and bigger suits, which was incredibly demoralising. Just to find that I'd obviously expanded and filled out a little more in my old age. But nevertheless, it was a real wake up call to me on, I guess, the passage of time and where I was at in my life. That I guess it was probably 10 years since I was fitted for a suit. But that was good. So, like I say, I haven't managed to get to the cinema, but I have been catching up with some bits that obviously we're going to be talking about today. Later on in the show, I definitely want to get to my A to Z of my DVDs. Last week, we kicked off with Martin Scorsese's After Hours, purely alphabetically, the first DVD in my DVD collection. And today, I know that we're up to Airplane, a true favourite of mine, and I look forward to getting into that one as well. But I know that there's a bit that you wanted to update us on today as well, Fletch.
That's right. Last week, I took a little trip to Bristol and caught up with my friend Karina Hubbard. I found the remnants of an old video rental store called 20th Century Flicks. I took a picture and then I noticed it had relocated to the Christmas Steps in town. I went there and it's of some historic significance. So 20th Century Flicks is, as far as I can tell, one of the last handful, if not the very last, VHS rental shop in England. And it was enjoyable to find that. They do DVD rental as well, and...
Whoa, slow down.
I know.
They do what? I'm assuming they haven't yet got to Blu-ray.
I didn't notice any in the store, but then I wasn't looking for them. What's fun about their VHS array is that they've kept on video anything that hasn't been released on DVD, and they've tried to limit the duplication between the two. So what they've got left on video is a lot of important stuff, which is slightly more difficult to find elsewhere.
Wow.
And so what I'm going to do over time is check out their website where they've got a database, and I'll try and get in touch with them and see if we can perhaps trade ideas to some extent. It was a nice little shop with interesting people in there. I asked them, though, how often do people rent videos from you? That is videos, not DVDs. Students were coming in all the time asking for various foreign films and early pictures by American independent directors. But I asked them how many VHS rentals a week, and she said... one.
Right.
And she said there's a few people that are working their way through the entire VHS collection.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of battery stuff as well. It's not all, as I said, they try to avoid duplication. But it was really lovely to get along and see a piece of British video rental cinema-going history.
Yeah.
And above the door, they've got a cheque signed by Simon Pegg to 20th Century Flicks, because, of course, Pegg is from that neck of the woods.
Yeah, absolutely. You say one, that there's like one VHS rental a week. So, pardon me if I'm missing something. What are they just making their money off the students coming to raid for their essay writing or whatever? Or like, how are they really going as a business? What's the deal?
So, the DVDs are going out regularly.
Okay.
I'd love to... What we really need to do is find out who is that one person who's renting every single week, who's renting regularly enough that it's every single week. They've also got a small cinema in there. I think it's 12-seat, maybe 15-seat, so that'll do little screenings. But it seems like Bristol's the sort of place which has a civic pride about it and a community spirit.
Mm.
And it's fiercely protective of this, and that's why it's above the door. They've got copies of the Three Cornettos trilogy,
mm,
signed by Simon Pegg, and they've got the check, and I can't remember the name of the film that was overdue. No, it was Crimes and Misdemeanors, I think,
right,
by,
yeah,
Woody Allen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he'd written them a note saying, here's the original rental price, plus...
That interest kind of thing.
Yeah, plus interest calculated over time, and he'd given them a check and signed it. So I thought that was a decent thing to do, and it gives them a little bump, because that would have been 3 or 4 years ago. Well, they had World's End on DVD.
Right.
Signed.
Yeah, I suppose.
So maybe,
yeah,
only
World's
2 or 3 years ago.
World's End wouldn't have come out on VHS. I bet Shaun of the Dead was on VHS.
Cusp. The last ever VHS made commercially available was A History of Violence.
Yeah, in the UK, I think it was actually Revenge of the Sith. It was.
You're kidding?
Yeah, in the States, they didn't release Revenge of the Sith on VHS, but in the UK, they did. So I guess it depends on territory. But yeah, History of Violence is up there, isn't it? And I know that for sure, because when we were living in Norwich, you and I definitely remember there was the Revenge of the Sith VHS in HMV. And I was really tempted to get it. I'd already had it on DVD, but I was tempted just because then I'd have had all the Star Wars on VHS. There's a little part of me that regrets that, actually, not doing that. But that's by the by.
In the same way that I regret spending money on food instead of getting the Beatific Visions by Breaks on 12-inch vinyl.
Oh, yeah.
Well, 12 years ago, I suppose it was, 11 or 12 years ago, I opted not to buy it because I was penniless. And we were at the gig at the Norwich Arts Centre.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Perhaps
when
you were with me,
there.
Perhaps you weren't. It would have been 11 years ago since it
that
was
the one when they kept breaking all the strings, wasn't it? Or
yeah. Yeah, I think, you know what, I think you're right.
And I was at the front and I said, just play another Camper Van Beethoven song. And Eamon, the singer, really laughed at that. He said,
people,
who said that?
You.
Who said that? And then he pointed at me and went, yeah.
What was the name of that basement we were in when you really got the bloke laughing, the acoustic guitar fella?
I don't remember that at all.
I can't repeat what it was you said, and it's a conversation for another time, but it was one of the smaller venues in Norwich. Don't go looking for it. It's not there anymore. I'm sure they've turned it into flats.
I'm looking at the Guardian article, and I do remember reading this on 20th Century Flicks, 30-year history there as the sort of the last video rental shop in the UK, and there it survives in Bristol. I do remember this Guardian article very well, and I'm really glad that you managed to make a little bit of a pilgrimage and go there. And you know, maybe one day, like you say, maybe we can have one of them on the show or whatever. We'll maybe have a word with them. That'd be amazing. But no, I'm glad you managed to find it and filling us in.
It was really enjoyable, and it was an impromptu pilgrimage as well. This so often happens when I go to new cities. I turn up and see something interesting and look into it rather than doing the sensible thing, which is performing a week or two's revision and planning and then knowing what I want to go to.
I think we can crack on with some of the hard news. There's definitely hard news, isn't it? We can crack on with some of that.
Yeah, there's a couple of little bits that I wanted to mention. I was heartened to see that there's a new ODR film coming out. That's the director of Deepan and Beat Them My Heart Skipped, a prophet. And he's making a film called The Sisters Brothers with Jake Gyllenhaal, Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly. So we're going to keep tabs on that. He's one of my favourite directors working today. Rust and Bone was his last but one film, really affecting, set down in Antibes in the south of France. And it's an area I know pretty well. I've vacationed there about a dozen times in the last 10 years. Pleased as well to see that John Carpenter on Twitter announced that the new Halloween film is going to be directed by David Gordon Green and written by David Gordon Green and Danny McBride. He says they've got the tone down, that they're taking it in an interesting direction, but one which is true to what Carpenter himself might be interested in. And
that's
that
good,
Carpenter
yeah.
is... Yeah, and he himself is considering writing the score for it. He's going to give it some thought.
Oh,
although you never know what... Sometimes on Twitter, people kind of spitball, don't they?
That's
it's
true.
As though they're typing it. And then they say, in a kind of Donald Trump way, yeah, I may do it myself.
Yeah.
And then you hear nothing about it for another 18 months, and then... Johnny, you doing it? I couldn't be bothered.
And it just becomes a bit of a footnote on Wikipedia that at one point they suggested they would do it themselves.
Which is essentially nonsense and a rumour, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then they go to them and say, no, something that I said once on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
No, it really wasn't. The more pressing news concerns me because I myself have a Cineworld card and I think I'm going to have to surrender it because my union, Bechtu, is on Saturday announcing a boycott of Cineworld because of its treatment through Picture House of its Picture House staff. I don't know if people out there are aware. Now, Luke, you know that Cineworld owns Empire.
I do, yes. In Pool, we had an Empire, which is now rebranded Cineworld, yeah.
Cineworld also owns Picture House. And in London, Cineworld, owners of Picture House, have refused to pay the living wage to staff.
Right.
Which isn't acceptable. I think you'll agree, and a lot of people out there would agree as well, especially those people that live in London, but hopefully people throughout the British Isles, and even if you're abroad, you would see that it's important to pay a living wage.
I agree with you. Certainly from a personal point of view, I do agree. And I think that the living wage is becoming, increasingly what we should all really be aspiring to instead of the minimum wage. That said, in the interest of good reporting, I suppose we should say it's not a legal obligation, and therefore one would hope that, good dialogue would ensue between unions and employers. But I guess in this instance, that hasn't necessarily happened in the sense that now they feel a boycott is necessary, I suppose.
Yeah, so the good people at Ritzy have been working with the Picture House management for a long, long time. It's years now, trying to get their fair dues, trying to get that living wage. The management at Ritzy and the management at Picture House have refused to relent. There's been incredible demonstrations and great work done by the people at Ritzy. And now Picture House Central, Crouch End, Hackney and Ritzy have all gone out and will all be going out on Saturday. There's a demonstration in Leicester Square. And through the union, Bec2, my union, there will be a boycott suggested. And it's supported by a set of luminaries, Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, Mark Rylance.
Right, yeah.
Heavy hitters, yeah, some real big people, some people that I think those are three of the most respected theatrical actors working today in Britain. And since Rylance decided he might make some films, those have certainly been well received as well. So Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, Mark Rylance are all supporting the boycott, as well as Ken Loach and Irvin Welsh.
Mm.
So this is a cause which is important to me and, broadly speaking, important to One Sensational Shot. And I do hope that people will take this to heart and think about their commitment to Cineworld, and especially if you've got a Cineworld card.
That,
as they say in Kill Bill Part 2, the only thing you kids understand is screwing with your cash.
Yeah.
Number one, I think it would be very difficult for most people to even communicate a boycott when they only go to the pictures 5 or 6 times a year.
Well, that's
very true. There are
very
few people like Luke and I, going 2 or 3 times a month. But think about where you're spending your money. If Cineworld is the only cinema in your area, then perhaps it might be a good time to get in touch with them by email, or Twitter's particularly effective, and tell them that you're not in favour of their employment practices, that you want to see people paid a living wage and treated fairly. You might have to make other arrangements on a Friday night until this is resolved. And myself, it's funny that 2 anniversaries come at once, because I think it was Hot Fuzz was either the first film I saw with my Cineworld card 10 years ago or the last film I saw without it. And so it's with some regret that I will relinquish my Cineworld card. I'd like to make that pledge now. I think it might not be in February. It's likely to be in March. I think what I'll do first is communicate my displeasure to them, write them the email and see what they say. But I'm lucky living in London. I've got a lot of memberships and a lot of selection. There's local community cinemas just in Ealing, but I've also got the Waltermans in Brentford down the road.
That's true.
Regent Street Cinema's one I enjoy. And I've already been to the Odeon twice this year as well. I don't like their policy on turning the lights down too low during the adverts.
Mm.
Not the trailers, but the adverts. So even just 2 minutes into the actual screening, you can't really see where you're going.
Yeah, yeah. And as someone who's been to see many films with you, you like to have a couple of toilet breaks in there during the adverts.
yeah, that's how it goes. So arrive for the screening, find your seat, immediately dash to the lab.
To be honest with I've adopted that. I think I'm getting older. I've adopted a similar policy, I must admit. And if they're turning the lights down too low, I'm going to struggle. I'm going to struggle to find my way back to my seat. But anyway, sorry, I don't mean to make too much light. It is a serious thing, and I got to say, whether it's a lot of more lower paid jobs, unfortunately, are falling into many traps, and I'm not talking specifically about this situation either. I'm really not. But similar traps of things like 0-hour contracts and part time work, all this kind of thing, and it can make for occasionally difficult working conditions and a difficult way to make a living. And that's why they call it the living wage in this instance. And yeah, I'm always in support of it. I truly am.
We simply shouldn't endorse this race to the bottom. And this is one way in which it's going to be very easy to express your displeasure with some terrible working practices by a company whose CEO receives an eye-watering bonus, something that you and I would... I won't say it's outrageous, but it's very surprising that a man whose base salary is 550 grand can take home a bonus of 349 grand and yet refuses to pay a living wage. Beck2 is supporting a boycott, a demonstration on Saturday in Leicester Square. That will have taken place by the time this goes live.
Is it just the Picture House staff where it's really the issue because they're refusing to pay a living wage to Picture House staff? And is that just in London alone? Does this extend to Cineworld staff, Empire staff, around the country? What's the crux of the matter? And I do apologise if I've slightly misunderstood.
No, not at all. So Cineworld doesn't pay a living wage to its staff anywhere.
No.
And it certainly doesn't pay a living wage to its London staff at its London Picture House cinemas.
Right.
And it's kind of, the situation is a bit like this. Picture House staff aren't getting the living wage, so there's no chance that Cineworld chain staff are going to be getting the living wage. The action is extending out to the Duke of York Cinema in Brighton. They're going to be balloting about whether they go on strike. For Picture House, this isn't just a London issue. It's going to be national very soon.
Mm.
The boycott, the demonstration, the thespians that they've got behind this cause are going to really push buttons. And what I'd like is, of course, that in 2 or 3 months of pressure, I can take my Cineworld card up again because it is useful.
But we need
to think about where we're spending our money. It's important to me to keep paying to see films at the cinema and keep paying for DVDs and downloads.
Yes, very true.
Because, you know, it's a very easy, very silly thing to say. And it's paraphrased George Hawkins as well, who said that people often claim that something is difficult when they want to behave like a bit of an arsehole, when they want to be lazy. And they'd, recycling, why do I have to do that? Why, they're just separate the plastics and the bean tins and the cardboards. That's very simple. And it's the same way in this. People will often use a bit of a straw man and they'll say, oh, Ryan Gosling's doing right for himself. Why should I have to pay for a film? Emma Stone's all right.
Yeah,
but what about the carpenters involved in the set creation? What about caterers on set and the electricians that are running the rigs and the wires across all of these sets? And the thing is that if there is less money because of illegal piracy, it's not just that we'll only get the very cheap films and the very expensive films, but how is it that workers will be able to make a fair wage when, in a race to the bottom, the carpenters, the electricians and the caterers are told, well, we can't afford to pay you. Will you work for less?
Mm.
Then they have to begin working for less. And then there's a smaller pool of people who are able to do that as their job. And then once there's a smaller pool of people, again, they can say, well, we can't afford this. Are any of you willing to pay, work for free? So, yeah, Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, they'll still be getting their pay packets. But think about the likes of you and I, people who'd be earning a reasonable living wage that they could support their families with, 30 grand, 40 grand, something like that, doing something that they love in film. And then over time, that's eroded because of illegal downloads, because people are dissuaded from going to the cinema. So that's why it's important to pay for things.
This is part of the problem as well, isn't it? I agree with what you're saying. But I know, so I can't mention any names here, but I know of one particularly large high street retailer that is going to start paying a living wage. And none of this is announced yet. And it's going to be a really big deal. I also know that it's costing them absolute millions. Millions and millions. But they're very keen to do it, and that's what they want to be about, which is great. But I do also know that they're doing very, very well, you know, in terms of what their business is all about. I suppose in contrast, cinemas, I mean, we all know what how cinemas have struggled, you know, and you've got 3D coming in 2010, and then it's the IMAX, and then it's 4K, and it could be argued that some of this is novelty gimmick-based features to try and get us back into the cinema and not either sitting at home streaming legally or at worst, you know, pirating and not paying for content, not paying for new films. So I suppose one could argue, if you were just trying to, you know, in the sake of fairness or reporting or whatever, that maybe the Cineworld group is sitting there thinking, looking at the bottom line and thinking, well, gee, you know, we don't know how to make much more money. We're charging as much for popcorn as we can, and I don't know how to make any more money out of this. And you know, could we get to a point where the cinema as a pastime as we know it, going out to the cinema on a Friday night in a multiplex or whatever, is that a bit of a dying breed anyway. I don't know. It's just a discussion point, really. It's just what I'm thinking.
Certainly, and I'll try and do some background reading on it, but what I can tell you is that the BFI pays a living wage to its staff at the South Bank. Cineworld is choosing not to, and that's why something needs to be done.
It's good that we've got some, you know, very notable people leading the charge there. Ken Loach, obviously, is someone who you'd probably expect to be at such an event. But we've got Serena McKellen and Sir Patrick Stewart as well, really big names. And correct me if I'm wrong, Fletch, but the last few times I've seen them at really big demonstrations in public supporting a minority or an underclass, there was like really big explosions and fights and CG that happened. So that when they were, you know, in support of their fellow mutants. So I suppose anything could happen.
Of course,
we don't know.
Yeah, when Ian McKellen goes under his nom de guerre, Eric Lensher, certainly. Yeah. So we'll move on in a moment, but I will say that anybody who's interested in getting more information on it should head to Facebook. And if you search for a living wage for Ritzy staff, then you'll find the page there. You can also do the same in a search engine. So get yourself educated on the subject. I still would urge people to get out to the cinema, although not a Cineworld this time, but do try to check out Fences and Moonlight and Hidden Figures. That's an interesting triumvirate. In some ways, a response to Oscars So White last year, I feel, although what's more likely is that they've been foregrounded, and as well they should be. Moonlight's getting some of the best notices of the decade. Gore Verbinski's new film, A Cure for Wellness, which sounds exciting. The trailers make it look terrible, but Dane DeHaan's in there with Jason Isaacs. But I've got some time for Verbinski. I'll never forget what he did with the remake of The Ring 15 years ago.
Sure.
Terrific film. Sure, terrific adaptation. Yeah, Hidden Figures was one which has kind of been swept alongside the foregrounded Black Experience films of the year, Moonlight and Fences. I'm not sure to Hidden Figures' quality. It's got a decent cast. It's in it, and no doubt an interesting story about some very accomplished, important and worthy people. I don't know how it's been executed. You know what, though? It's by the bloke... I saw this on Charlie Rose. It's by the bloke who did St. Vincent.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which we watched together with Tom Rafe, didn't we?
We certainly did. One of the more recent Bill Murray films, Melissa McCarthy. Really, really good film, that one. And I enjoyed Bill Murray's performance in that.
So I think what we can say about the director of these films, Ted Melfi, is that with St. Vincent, he was able to take kind of a TV movie concept and elevate it with his capable direction and with decent performances from some proper stars like Bill Murray and Naomi Watts and Melissa McCarthy. And I think the same thing has been done with Hidden Figures. It sounds like something that would have been a television movie 10, 15 years ago.
Right, right.
But he's got the right people involved and he's committed to it. I saw him speaking on Charlie Rose about it, and I'm going to give it a go if I'm able. But I will be prioritising Fences and Moonlight. And you know what? I'm going to see how we go with Cure for Wellness as well, because
I'm going to try and check it out. Yeah.
It could definitely be the sort of film that makes no money but is actually dynamite.
Yeah.
And if it does fail, I think it's got a chance of failing in an interesting way.
Flight 209er, you are cleared for takeoff.
Roger.
Huh? LA departure frequency 123.9er.
Roger.
Huh?
Request vector. Over.
What?
Flight 209er clear for vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence. Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
So I went to see Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. The only reason that I got to see that was because I'd gone into London to Cineworld Haymarket. So I wanted to see Silence. We were quite geared up for it, or physically preparing ourselves for Scorsese's Silence. And instead there was Silence, because they'd taken it off at very short notice, at about 24 hours notice. And they put on Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which I want to refer to from now on as Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Wank. Not because it's a bad film. It's all right, but it...
You've definitely earned us the explicit rating that we've got on the on iTunes, which really upsets me as well, because I wanted this to be more of a family show. But here we are standing on soapboxes, and
we're socialist agitators with potty mouths.
Exactly, potty mouths.
But it's Ang Lee's new film. And it's all right, but the convoluted production history is more diverting than the film itself.
Yeah.
Ang Lee decided that he would shoot this at 120 frames
a second. So this is the one thing now, I've heard online, and just in the media in general, is that this is basically shot in Super Hobbit, which is what I'm going to start calling it, I think. Because wasn't The Hobbit in some silly amount of frames a second, which kind of was just about all right, but a lot of people are upset with. But this is set...
Because it looked like Neighbours. Yeah,
this is set in shot in Super Hobbit, which can only mean it looks like it's happening right in front of you, and therefore, from what I've heard, people are basically saying it takes you out of the film. It's just talking about, go back to suspension of disbelief, it's just not there.
Yeah, so standard is 24, that's industry standard, and then Hobbit was at 48, and in production for the film, Ang Lee checked out what Douglas Trumbull was doing. He's trying things at 60, and James Cameron was also experimenting with 60. Yeah, yeah. So Lee went double that, 120 frames a second. There's only 6 theatres that are equipped to exhibit it at that, and that's in the world, and a couple of them are in China. Nice. And none of them are the film that I saw it, are the cinema that I saw it at, and so I think I saw it in regular old 2D. There were a couple of sequences where I got a feeling that something was up, that it was lost in translation, but it may have been imagined in a for a different kind of exhibition. Mm-hmm. But I just saw it in 2D, so unfortunately, no one's gone to see this film, and everything that Ang Lee did to make it exceptional in its visuals has been lost because no theatres have really been able to kit it out in the way that it needs to be.
Yeah.
And it's also no surprise that it hasn't done well, because just while I was watching it, I was thinking about how few Iraq War 2 films have done any business at all, and there's been quite a few of them, and some of them are decent. Stop Loss is all right. I thought Green Zone was very good.
We had the Hurt Locker.
But they didn't. Yeah, Hurt Locker's one of the exceptions, but then usually it's they try and do a drama like in The Valley of Allah, which isn't really about the Iraq War. It's more like the emotional responses to it and shell-shocked victims returning home. And in The Valley of Allah is more of a detective story with Tommy Lee Jones investigating what it is that happened to his son.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Home of the Brave went straight to DVD. The Messenger with Woody Harrelson by Oren Moverman, that's another one where it's more about the emotional fallout than the actual conflict. Lions for Lambs did no business. It's just, and even De Palma's, I think it was De Palma that did Redacted. People don't want to know. I'm not quite sure why that is.
We were talking about World Trade Center the other day, Rolling Stone, weren't we? And it felt like it only just happened, and you and I were sitting in the movies. Was it 2005 watching that? So
there has been no resolution to the Iraq War and Afghanistan. People aren't really clear. People know when it started. They're not really clear when it finished, if indeed it has finished. We're still waiting for a proper definitive endpoint to it. Vietnam, in contrast, did have shots of helicopters being pushed off of troop transits. It did have people fleeing Saigon. So everybody knew, and off the top of my head, I'm afraid I don't know the exact point that the Vietnam War ended for American troops, but it was in 74 or in 75. And very soon afterwards, comparatively, you had films like Coming Home and The Deer Hunter and then Apocalypse Now. Yeah. So by the end of the 70s, within 5 or 6 years, you had important Academy Award-winning, mass-release, very successful films about which explored the reaction to Vietnam. Those films didn't necessarily depict the bullets of the conflict, but they did show people in Vietnam, and they showed the emotional fallout, and those films did very well. And Apocalypse Now, we can say that it's not really about Vietnam, but certainly it has the combat sequences in it are definitely of Vietnam.
Yeah.
My first response is that probably we're not really sure if the Iraq War's over, and so it's difficult to make cinema about it. Certainly nobody was interested in cinema during it, with the exception of The Hurt Locker, which, if we're honest, it's not about Iraq. It's about a very specific set of people engaging in a very specific task, bomb disposal, centering on 3 or 4 or 5 people. It's more about the intensity and the drive of the characters who happen to be doing it in a conflict environment. But The Hurt Locker would probably work just as well if it were in any conflict, perhaps even if it were like the film Blown Away, if it were police bomb disposal experts. I'll have to think about that, but yeah, off the top of my head, that's the main difference. We don't know when did Iraq finish. 7 years ago, 9 years ago, is it still going on? It's difficult
George
to say.
George Bush tried to have the PR stuff where
mission
that
accomplished.
That was it. That was the bit on the aircraft carrier. But obviously that isn't the case. I guess it's gotten more confusing. Terrorism has persisted and risen in different groups, or claiming to be various factions with various names, and I guess it's gotten to the point where most people, you really do need to become an expert in the situation before you can understand it, whereas I suppose you could argue with Vietnam, we were still dealing, at least from a PR point of view, in kind of the two-dimensional, where it was, you know, against communism, I suppose. Maybe it was just a little more two-dimensional. There was a definite end to NAM, and people, they got out, and that was what it was.
Yeah, and the American verdict is World War II, we won. Vietnam, we lost. Iraq, too. Sort of difficult to say. The phrase you hear over and over again is that they wanted to finish the job. And you hear that from top to bottom. Mm. Grunts on the ground say, we just wish we had the opportunity to finish the job. I don't know what finishing the job means. And I don't know if they necessarily do either. But it's something that we'll think about. And if I'm able to come up with a thesis statement, we'll return to it for an entire episode, maybe.
Stand by for the most extraordinary chain of events ever swept up into high adventure.
Hey, Larry, where's the forklift?
Forklift! It's over there for the baggage loader.
Airplane. Airplane is drama.
This is Dr. Brody at the Mayo Clinic.
There's a passenger on your Chicago flight 209er, a little girl named Lisa Davis, en route to Minneapolis. She's scheduled for a heart transplant.
I want you to make sure that she's kept
in a reclined position and that a continuous watch is kept on her IV.
Airplane is action. Airplane is romance.
I love you, Elaine.
I love you.
Airplane is music.
There is only one river. There is only one sea.
Airplane is dancing. Never has the screen been so big.
You ever been in a cockpit before?
No, sir, I've never been up in a plane before.
Peter Graves.
You ever seen a grown man naked?
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
My name is Roger Murdoch. I'm an airline pilot.
Leslie Nielsen.
This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
Lloyd Bridges.
Johnny, what can you make out of this?
This? Well, I can make a cap. Or a brooch. Or a pterodactyl.
Robert Stack.
All right, Steve, let's face a few facts.
And we hope you enjoy the rest of your flight.
Julie Haggerty.
By the way, is there anyone on board who knows how to fly a plane?
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Robert Hayes.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here. Down, get a hold of yourself.
Please, let me handle this.
Get back to your seat. I'll take care of this. Calm down. Calm down. Get a hold of yourself.
Don't be one of the fool. Everything's been pulled. Just a minute.
Don't handle this.
Mayday. Mayday.
The most incredible adventure the screen has ever created.
He's coming right at us!
The big news is... Airplane.
Okay, so cracking on with my A to Z. Luke's A to Z, obviously, as people who've tuned into the previous episode will know, occurred to me that I'm obviously increasingly streaming and just watching through whether it's Netflix, I have Sky, Now TV, that kind of thing, and that tends to be where I'm watching my films at home more and more, and obviously the cinema we talk about an awful lot, going to see new releases, but I wanted to crack open my old DVD collection that was just sitting there not doing an awful lot. There was films that occurred to me that I hadn't seen in a long time. So I set myself a challenge, originally a personal challenge, and now one that we're very proud to bring to the show, of going through my DVD collection in A to Z, no matter what? And we've got some, because after this one, we're going to hit Alien, and I've got, of course, all four of the original Alien films. So Fletch and I were talking just prior to going on air, and we are going to probably group those up and talk about them, you know, as a franchise, I suppose, and talk about the highs, the lows, and how we think about the Alien films. But last week was After Hours, the first DVD in my collection, Martin Scorsese's underrated mid-80s One Crazy Night kind of genre of films. And if you want to catch up on that one, do go back to the previous episode and listen to it, because that's definitely one of my favourite films of all time. So it was a great one to get cracking with. But this one almost requires no introduction. I could be wrong. We come to Airplane. In my opinion, I know Mel Brooks came before, but in my opinion, the original parody film, in a certain sense, it's definitely got started on the modern parody film, I suppose, as we know it today. Released 1980, and of course this gave us really the Zucker brothers, David Zucker, Jerry Zucker, and also Jim Abrams, as a trio of directors who would obviously go on to arguably even greater success with the Naked Gun trilogy. You know, this really launched the second career of Leslie Nielsen. I had previously been a straight man in films like the original Poseidon Adventure, things like that, and suddenly had this second career through Airplane as playing the straight man, but in comedy films, and I suppose a knowing straight man, the guy that you do know from Naked Gun. You know, this is where that character kind of developed. He plays the doctor on the airplane in the film Airplane. It's a film that I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of. I think one of the things that is interesting, I know when we were talking about the idea of me going through my A to Z of films, it's a little bit like going through your record collection. Because your record collection is something that's very personal to you. It is physical. And it's something that Spotify or Tidal or whatever streaming service it is can't quite replace. Because when you're flipping through your CDs or your vinyl records, you do remember where you were when you purchased those. And you do remember where you were, not only geographically, but where you were at in your life, in your head, in your mind, and how you were feeling. And your DVD collection is very, very similar to that. And when I went through Airplane, you know, After Hours, like I said, I remembered coming home from a gig one night that I'd played with my band The Waxing Captors as a teenager, and seeing that film on late night, and then going out to buy the DVD in my first year of university to finally catch up and see the film from the beginning, because I hadn't even seen it from the beginning. Airplane is an interesting one, because to go with that Waxing Captors connection of my band from many years ago now, this was a film I bonded over with Jack Rundle, one of my best friends. And it's a little bit of a personal story, but Jack Rundle and I, so Jack played guitar in the Waxing Captors, and, you know, he was on the stag do that Fletch was at and talking about earlier on, and he's one of my very, very best friends, and always will be. And we were very best friends also at primary school, and we were in a band at primary school as well called the Parasites. And then we went to high school, and we knew each other. It wasn't a huge high school, but by the time we were about 12, 13, we'd drifted apart a little bit and fallen into slightly different groups. And it seems a bit trivial now, because obviously we talk to each other all the time and, you know, see each other all the time. And, you know, he's going to be a huge part of the wedding and that kind of thing. So so there's no, you know, our friendship is certainly cemented. But it did feel like, I guess, an age at high school where we weren't really hanging out. When we were about 15, we started to just hang out a little bit more again, and we started to talk about putting a band together. Jack was already playing in another group. They weren't really a final lineup, and it was in a little bit of flux. And then he asked me to be the singer of the group, and that's when we formed the Waxing Captors. I remember it was the last day of term before summer, and we were queuing at the school office door. I can't remember what for. Maybe it was like locker keys or something. Something you do on the last day of term. But we were there queuing up, and he was talking to me about Airplane. And I wasn't aware of it. I was aware of the Naked Gun films. And he didn't tell me necessarily that it was David Zucker, Jerry Zucker. I'm not sure if he was aware. I can't remember. So, but he was definitely saying, look, it's this film. It's the funniest film I've ever seen. It's the most hilarious thing you've ever seen. And he was taking me through a lot of the really big gag moments. And he was telling me about one of my favourite moments, which will forever be one of my favourite jokes because of this moment. One of the female passengers on the aeroplane is in hysterics and is freaking out. And then Leslie Nielsen sort of is trying to calm her down and gives her a slap. And then And then I think the nun sort of says, no, doctor, you're wanted in the cockpit. No, calm down, and starts to shake her even more violently and then gives her a bigger slap. And then someone else taps the nun on the shoulder and says, no, let me deal with this. I can handle this. Calm down, and gives her, like, smashes her in the face. And then the camera pans and we see a huge queue of people, like one with a crowbar, one with a gun, a revolver ready to shoot her. As we see that this trying to sort of electroshock her back into coherence is going to become increasingly violent. And it's a great moment of the movie. And that was one of the moments that I remember Jack was talking to me about, standing in the queue for the school office on the last day of term in year 10 in the summer of 2001, I guess that would have been. I realized that I had to go check out Airplane. Luckily, we had Sky TV and it was playing, I guess, regularly on one of the Sky channels. So I went home, checked it out, and that was the first time I ever saw Airplane, and it absolutely blew me away. So I don't know, Fletch, when was the first time you saw Airplane?
I think I stayed up with my mum and watched it one Christmas. Can't remember which Christmas. I don't know how old I was. I would have been some age between 11 and 16. And we ate loads of poppets. We had a jar of Sainsbury's own poppets. We were working our way through those. My favourite character has always been Stephen Stucker's Johnny. What do you make of this? Oh, I can make a brooch and I can make a duck.
Yeah, he's yeah. Great.
Have you seen this? Oh my God, there's a sale at Penny's.
He is. It really is. He's stereotypically gay. I guess in the 80s that was easy to get away with. And there's some homophobic jokes, some casual homophobic jokes. There's Saturday Night Fever parody where our lead character, he's as Ted Stryker is the main character, of course, played by Robert Hayes, and he's dancing like John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. There's a moment where I think he asks the guy next to him to pinch him because he's seen a woman so beautiful, and he must have her, must dance with her, and the guy looks him up and down in disgust and walks away. So a little bit of casual homophobia there. So the film is of its time, and I'm sure the Zuckers and Abrams would be perfectly, you know, in acceptance of that. But like I say, it's the original parody film that you did get Mel Brooks before that. And I did go through the internet trying to look for this particular anecdote. But I remember me reading a magazine article many years ago where they said that there was a bit of an urban legend that Mel Brooks had sort of shed a tear whilst watching Airplane because he realized that there was now a bunch of kids that could do it better than him. I couldn't find any reference to that online. So whether that's true or not, or like I say, firmly in the urban legend category, I don't know. But I think one of the things to say about Airplane over Blazing Saddles or The Producers is, I guess, just the gag per second ratio is probably, you know, they really do come thick and fast. And it is the prototype of what you get with the more modern parody films. And I think the Zuckers, didn't they even end up directing Scary Movie 3? And didn't they start getting involved in that?
Yeah, they came in,
yeah. It was really odd to me. I kind of felt like the Mighty had fallen a little bit by that point when they were getting involved in the Scary Movie franchise. But
Jerry went off and made Ghost and First Knot, and then they came back together eventually. I can't remember if the Zuckers were involved in Hot Shots and Hot Shots Part 2. I think they were, but I think maybe Pat Proft or Jim Abrahams directed them. Spy Hard wasn't Zuckers, but it was Leslie Nielsen, and they're kind of diminishing returns with Leslie Nielsen, Dracula Dead and Loving It was pretty whack.
Yeah, but the reason I actually mentioned that particular scene as well is because in this instance, when I rewatched it the other day as part of my A to Z, because I've seen the film so many times, I actually watched it with the director's commentary, and they kind of just joked about it that, oh, it's a bit of, it's just a homophobic joke. But they kind of called it out themselves as filmmakers. I suppose I'd point that out. But and I suppose I'm moving on a little bit. One of the other things they mentioned, which I thought was really interesting, was that when in the opening scenes, they're in the Fletch, I know that you've got Kentucky Fried Movie on VHS, and that was their first film, which is parody of you know, sort of like a sketch movie and a parody of late night ads and cheap commercials. And they were recording, though, the reason the film came to be is because they were recording those cheap commercials to try and riff off them and come up with parodies of them. And then one night, I think they managed to catch Zero Hour, this old black and white disaster film about an airplane, which was really cheesy and not very well made. And therefore, they wanted to just riff on that and create a parody of that. And a lot of the dialogue in Airplane is actually directly lifted from Zero Hour. word for word, and to the point where they actually purchased for a grand sum of $2,500 the remake rights to Zero Hour, so they wouldn't get sued for it or anything like that. But what was interesting to me is one of the comments they made was that at the beginning of the film, when they're in the airport, and Robert Hayes' character Ted Stryker is talking to his ex-girlfriend Julie Haggerty, playing Elaine, and he's trying to coax her back into, you know, starting a relationship again. They're in the airport, they're in a busy corridor in LAX, and he said they said in the director's commentary they couldn't close that down at all. So a lot of the people in the background are not extras, they're just people that are going to on holiday or whatever, and they've got the really big 70s collars, and they said it's a real shame because they wanted to go real 1950s with it to give it a timeless quality. And actually, when you get on the aeroplane itself, you'll notice that everyone has the smaller 50s collars, and it feels then more timeless. It's not going to date. And, you know, at one point I kind of felt, is it the Korean War? But no, you're right. A lot of the flashback stock footage that they use is, it gets increasingly silly, because when he's really freaking out at one point, they have like, it flashes back, and it obviously overlays all this black World War II footage or whatever with dogfights. But then I think increasingly as he gets very upset later on in the film and is increasingly under pressure to fly the aeroplane back home to safety, they overlay it with black and white footage of like the Wright brothers and people coming up with contraptions to try and fly, where they've got like wooden wings and trying to jump off cliffs and whatever, which is really, really good. But I suppose, yeah, moving on a little bit, it was, like I say, parody Zero Hour. There is an attempt to make it timeless, and it really is the originator of parody films, and that's why, purely as for historical interest, if you haven't seen it, I think that you would want to go back and see it. And just the gag per minute ratio is unreal. The amount of little asides, little lines that are just thrown in, and stuff that you don't even pick up on the first time. There was a line when I was watching it last night in preparation for this. He's a danger to everyone who's up in the air. Anything that's up in the air. Yes, birds too. And it's just little lines like that where they make you snigger and you go, oh, I'd even miss that. That's great. It's a special, special film. And I do enjoy the sequel as well. I don't own it on DVD, so we won't be covering the sequel. And that's funny for lots of different reasons. The fact that it's set in the near future, the fact that it has William Shatner as a cameo star. But Airplane, yeah, I mean, we could go on and talk about it a bit more, but I'm very wary of how familiar people might be with it. And just to put into perspective, one of the notes I did write down in terms of why this was such a success, or at least why it spawned such a love of parody films, or in the sense that Hollywood wants to make lots of them. $3.5 million was the budget, and that was in 1980. You got to think Star Wars in 77 was made for sort of 8-9 million. I think that ballooned above that as well. So this was $3.5 million in 1980, which was peanuts. This was no money whatsoever, and the box office was 130 million. So obviously, return on investment is right there. And on the director's commentary as well, they do joke an awful lot about the sets, and they keep trying to point out the scotch tape or whatever that's just holding the sets together. What's funny is when I first watched it, I thought the production value was pretty decent. There's a lot of model shots of the airplane, and they are made to look cheap. They are, but I didn't think it was that bad, considering it wasn't actually an action film, and I knew it in my heart of hearts it didn't have a big action film budget. I thought they looked all right. Even the opening shot where it's a Jaws pastiche, and there's a lot of cloud cover, and you see the fin of an airplane moving through the cloud, like Jaws, and then it comes flying up in front of the camera. I thought that looked all right. But yeah, there we go. Made for like no money, but made all of the money, I suppose, is a way to put that as succinctly as possible.
You mentioned Leslie Nielsen, and it features other prestige actors, dramatic actors.
Yeah.
I have a very particular anecdote about Robert Stack, and it's one of those things that you would only know about if you've actually been to the place. There's so much you can read around a topic, and it's a little bit like the monologue that Robin Williams delivers to Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting. You can reel off facts and you can read books about something, but you can't tell me how the Sistine Chapel smells.
It's true, yeah.
When I was in Amsterdam, I went to the Anne Frank house, and she had Robert Stack on her wall.
Ah.
And that's the sort of thing that really brings it home and really reaches across generations to impress upon you how close we were to this. I couldn't believe it at first. It's Robert Stack. It clearly is him. Anne Frank had taken a newspaper clipping. She also had Our Queen as a girl on the wall. But close to that, she had Robert Stack from a publicity shot. And it's because Robert Stack was acting as early as the
third. Yeah, and he's first... Kramer, isn't he? He comes in halfway through. That's Captain Rex Kramer. Yeah.
He does the joke with the glasses where he's wearing two pairs of
sunglasses.
Yeah, he
takes off the first pair dramatically, only to have another pair underneath, which he can then take off even more dramatically when he has another more interesting point to make in the next sentence.
And so his first set of films were coming out in the early 40s. He made a picture called First Love in 39, and then he worked consistently in 40, 41, 42. And he was in the original To Be or Not to Be by Ernst Lubitsch, which is about the Nazi occupation of Poland. And so often when you visit tourist hotspots, you run the risk of not taking that much from it. There's a lot that you can take already from reading about something and from seeing pictures of something. But that felt really personal and unique to me, to see that on her wall. And I've always remembered
that. That's really interesting.
It's not the sort of thing I wouldn't say to people, hey, check it out yourself next time you're in Amsterdam. But nothing had a greater emotional resonance for me than to think that this girl had the same pursuits that we did at the time that she was growing up, to the extent that we even knew the people that she put on her wall as a teenager.
Yeah,
girl.
Yeah.
That's how close we were to it. Amazing to me.
Yeah, it is. Just because it's World War II's in black and white, it's very easy to think it was a long time ago. It wasn't, is the truth of it. You know, it's like Spielberg shot Saving Private Ryan in that washed out colour. A, because war is hell, I suppose, but B, because that's almost how you think World War II looked. It's always very jarring when you see it in proper colour. Some of the footage that is available, and you go, oh, it was colourful. And then it really does look like yesterday.
But you raise an interesting point, because Spielberg shot Saving Private Ryan like that because he wanted to imitate the photography of Robert Capa, who landed on D-Day. He shot so much. And only, in the end, I think maybe a dozen photographs were salvaged because something about, unfortunately, the office junior, like the studio apprentice, was given this absolute goldmine of war photography reportage and screwed it up. Yeah, so Spielberg based it on the photography of Capa. Had he not taken that decision, maybe we wouldn't think of World War II in those terms, because now we all do. For the last 20 years... World War II, Saving Private Ryan, that's what World War II looks like to us. It looks like Saving Private Ryan, and then 4 or 5 years later, Steven Spielberg worked on Band of Brothers, and he brought us a very similar aesthetic with the silver nitrate
process. It has
a
knock-on effect as well, because then all of the video games look like that as well. Do you know what I mean? It just knocks on in pop culture, doesn't it?
Subsequently, there was a spate of whenever war was depicted, it was depicted in that handheld style. Malick didn't do anything like that, of course, with Thin Red Line. You're in the sometimes lush mangrove forests and grassy hills of the Japanese islands in the Pacific. It's incredibly green and pastoral and even calming. Yeah. It's interesting how our perception of things are shaped by cinema in that way.
Oh, absolutely.
Spielberg was just, he was on a bit of a tear at the time, though. He did Saving Private Ryan in that way. Minority Report has that same
look to it.
It does,
yeah, I'd agree with that.
It's Janusz Kaminski mainly. In fact, on a couple of US airings on US television of Saving Private Ryan, they tried to reverse the silver nitrate process, and there was furious phone calls.
Oh, really? I didn't know about that. What?
Yeah, no, I'm not even...
I thought you were doing a joke.
It does sound like...
You're quite right. I do take your point on that one. But in terms of My A to Z Airplane, wow, what a movie. Grand originator, I think, of the modern parody film. It did give us the second career of Leslie Nielsen. And quick-fire gags and aside, we should have probably just run through lots of our favourite gags in the movie. I always do use, to this day in the office, is looks like I picked a bad week to quit amphetamines.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, but loads of in terms of quick cuts, quick asides, lots of absurdist, surrealist humor. It's all in there, and worth checking out.
It's definitely one of those comedies where you keep seeking increasingly obscure funny points. One of the reasons I like Johnny is because he's overlooked, and I think Robert Stack's monologue over the radio at the end is overlooked as well. He keeps going, doesn't he? After the plane's been landed, he's still talking about.
Yeah, he keeps saying. He carries on and starts to, like, even though they've left the cockpit and they've successfully landed the plane, everyone's happy. He's still talking on the radio, saying, "What?" Trying to reminisce. Like, he gets to the point where he's using it for counselling, and then he's saying. I guess that's why I've always been angry or whatever. And he says something like, Christmas, what does Christmas mean to you? Oh, I guess that's a stupid point anyway. Forget I said it. And then it keeps going on and on. It's really great. I mean, I kept scribbling. I'm looking down at my notes, was scribbling down so many notes on my favorite moments. I always like, that's impossible, they're on instruments. And then it cuts to the crew in the cockpit, and they're playing New Orleans jazz on instruments, which is great.
One of the wackier bits I enjoy, and again, there's such a breadth of jokes within the film.
Yeah, there's broad stuff, there's surreal stuff.
It goes all over the shop.
It really is. It's everything. It really is. And then, you know, there's homages to other films. There's like a From Here to Eternity bit. There's the Saturday Night Fever bit. It really is all sorts. But sorry, what was one of your favorite bits?
Roger Murdoch. I'm a pilot, and the kid says, I think you're the greatest, but my dad says you don't work hard enough on your defense. The hell I don't. I've been hearing that crap ever since I was at UCLA. I'm out there busting my buns every, yeah. You know. And suddenly they admit that it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I don't even know why he was cast in the first place. But then to have that vignette really, really works.
Yeah, there is a reason he was cast in the first place. It's because there was a similar guy in Zero Hour, the original 50s film that was
right
I can't remember who it was, but there was a sports person in that film who I guess was becoming an actor or whatever, so that's why they have the gag that they cast a basketball player in. But of course the joke in Airplane is that he actually is the basketball player pretending to be a pilot.
Yeah.
And I really like when he eventually passes out, because the reason the airplane's in crisis is that they all ate the fish. And the fish was bad, so everyone goes into it, becomes very ill. And when they actually pull him out of the co-pilot's seat, when you realise that he has the co-pilot's uniform on the top half, and on the bottom half he's still got his basketball shorts and sneakers, which is really great. It's so many fantastic moments in that, and it was so great. Even though I hadn't seen the film, Jack Rundle in that queue at school, and as a kid, telling me about all of his favourite moments in this movie, telling me it was the funniest film he'd ever seen.
Do you remember as well in Basketball when Robert Vaughn has Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in a glass case in his museum?
Yeah, I do remember that, and he moves. Yeah, and in fact, I should have mentioned that that David and Jerry Zucker went on to do, like I said, Naked Gun, all sorts, but they were involved in Basketball. I think they directed as well, and Basketball is one of my other favourite films with Trey Parker and Matt Stone of South Park fame, and we've got that coming up when we get to the B's of my DVD collection, so I look forward to that. Really love
it's
it.
One of my favourites.
There's lots of... My best man, John, who's going to be at my wedding, obviously as the best man, that's a film that we bonded over the years a lot, and there's lots of one-liners from Basketball that to this day we say I love you, always have.
I checked out the name of the sportsman turned actor, Elroy Hirsch, although he was known as Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch, so no kidding, he was an athlete. We should move on to talking about Hot Fuzz, because it's been 10 years since its release. One of my favorite films of the century, absolutely crystallizes what it is that Edgar and Simon do really well. But from next week, I'll have my own little feature to run alongside Luke's A to Z. For a long time now, I've been working through my Criterion collection. It didn't go that well last year. I was diligent for 3 or 4 months, and then we got some sunshine, so I just began sunbathing.
For anyone doubting Fletch, speaking as a guy who's lived with him, when you go out in the sun, he does look like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate, in the swimming pool, sunning himself.
At least you didn't say Ray Winston in Sexy Beast. That was very kind of you. So over the last almost 15 years, I've been collecting Criterion Collection DVDs. I started my collection when I was living in California, and have continued to collect them essentially by mail order. I pick them up whenever they're half price at Borders or at the Criterion website itself. And I found myself last year with well over 100 of them, and about half of them I'd never even watched. Some of them were real monoliths like Seventh Seal, and so I was put off by their reputation. Wasn't sure if I had essentially the emotional and the intellectual capacity to enjoy them. Next week, I'll be talking about Haxan, very old, 1922. It's about witchcraft. It's a kind of a documentary about witchcraft. And so over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at Traffic, Royal Tenenbaums, Contempt, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Yeah. So there's a nice mixture there, and I'll try to keep up with that. I don't think I'm going to be able to commit, as you have done, to one a week. We'll be looking at it every so often.
Yeah, and obviously I've got the list as we go, which will be great, because I won't be able to watch all of the same ones that you're watching, but I'll be able to catch up with some of them, and I look forward to doing that as we go as well.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Basically, my remit for putting together my wedding playlist was it had to be pre-2008, it had to be pre-crash, when life was better. Yeah. So that was my remit, and so much of that stuff that's in there, stuff that I haven't listened to ever since the first and second year of university, makes me very reminiscent of hanging out with you and going to that stuff. And at the time, I hated a lot of it as well. I didn't like We Are Scientists. I thought it was rubbish. But putting it on a playlist, nostalgia's a powerful thing. You know, it works.
You said they were funnier than they were.
Yeah, I think we... Do you remember going to see, like, one of the NME tours? And they had We Are Scientists on. And I think before they were on, didn't they have a video playing of all their sketches they used to do? And I thought, you know what, they're really...
You know who they did them with? Lonely Island. Akiva Schaffer directed those, and Yuma Tacona.
Man, I should have paid more attention at the time.
Oh, I didn't know that at the time, because we didn't know who the Lonely Island were. This was 2005, 2006.
No, they weren't. When were they doing SNL sketches? When was that? Like,
I first watched Lazy Sunday on YouTube, in YouTube's infancy, and that will have been in the year 2006. But we can be forgiven for not knowing who Akiva Schaffer was at the time. There are plenty of people who don't know who Akiva Schaffer is now. And he directed last year's best comedy. So
yeah, and for more information on that, refer to the second episode of One Sensational Shot, Films of 2016, Part 2. But anyway...
There's so much more that we could talk about, which I think we're going to have to save for another time. I wanted to draw attention to how it's the 30th, if you can believe it, 30th anniversary of the US releases of a couple of Andrew McCarthy, James Spader films. Some Kind of Wonderful, which is a favourite of mine. A Mannequin, which Luke has been threatening to watch forever. It was one of the first things we talked about in our lives together when we were at mine. You said to me that you'd never seen it, and you had a conceit of it that it was something greater than it actually was. And I thought, what an odd film to have never seen but really be excited for. It's on all of the time, it felt like. In my youth, it was on like 6 p.m. on BBC Two. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting bloke that he really wants to watch Mannequin. I'm not saying that isn't to belittle you in any way. I thought that was a very precise desire. And it's the same with me. I hadn't seen Adventures in Babysitting for years and years, and I really wanted to. So it's 30 years since those films,
I still haven't seen Mannequin.
In future, we'll somehow commemorate that. Well, we're going to have to watch it together then. Maybe we can fit it in after the wedding.
I still really want to see it as well.
Its US release was the 13th of February, but since we're in its anniversary year, I think it's perfectly appropriate if we watch it as late as March
okay.
or April or June.
So long as it's appropriate. So we'll... That's
And then looking forward to next week's show, as we've mentioned, in the A to Z, we'll be looking at the Alien films. We're not sure how many of them. Certainly we'll discuss Alien and Aliens, and maybe even the much maligned David Fincher Alien 3.
I think we'll do it. Let's just do it. It's a franchise. Let's just do the four.
Shall we
blitz it?
Throughout the year, we're going to be commemorating the work of Shane Black. He's one of my favourite writers of all time, and he's proven himself a very able director as well. Last year, we had The Nice Guys, which Luke is going to watch on DVD this year, or on download. Hopefully DVD. You know, I might even buy it for you. We might even go that far. And we've also got coming up the 30th anniversaries of Lethal Weapon, The Monster Squad and Predator, the 25th anniversary of Lethal Weapon 3, and next week, we'll be commemorating the 25th anniversary of Tony Scott's The Last Boy Scout.
I just want to tell you both good luck. We're all counting on you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this edition of One Sensational Shot. And I'd just like to draw you guys' attention to all the ways you can keep in touch with us and give us a shout. So there's the onesensationalshot.com website. So give us a shout on onesensationalshot.com. There's also other ways to get in touch as well. We are on Twitter. If you go to @onesensational, you can find us on there. And also, if you just search One Sensational Shot on Facebook, we're on there too. But like I say, onesensationalshot.com is, I suppose, the hub where you can get to any place that you need to get to in order to keep in touch with us. The other thing I'll say is that we are on iTunes, we are on Stitcher, and most places you can find good podcasts. We are there, and you can find our feed and subscribe to us. Do give us a subscribe. But most importantly, I think, you know, we are a fledgling show. Please do give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Really helps other people find out about us and learn more about what we're doing. This is the One Sensational Shot team signing off.
Give him another 20 minutes. But that's it.